Hello, welcome. Holiday greetings to you here on the Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoog, your host. Glad to have you with us today here on the program as we strive to bring you whatever's going on in town and give you a, you know, give you perhaps a little artistic type briefing on what's going to be happening as you make your decisions through this busy holiday season. Today we're going to talk about two shows that really don't fit into the holiday mold, and for that I thank them. But of course I get pretty much burned out on holiday shows after a while, but still plenty of really good holiday shows going on in town. But it's a Unicorn Theater. They're doing two shows actually in repertory over there, and neither one of them really have a Christmas theme. Maybe there's a deep-seated theme, holiday-type theme in the shows that we can talk about. But two good shows over there. We'll cover one in the first half of the program. We'll cover the other one in the second half of our program here today on the Arts Magazine Show. The first show we're going to talk about, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, is going on right now at the Unicorn Theater. It will play through December the 28th, basically a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday afternoon matinee show throughout the time. And with us to tell us all about the director and the lead actor in the show, Ian R. Crawford is with us. He is the director of the show. He is also has extensive credits with design, both set design and lighting design in many shows he's done, both here in the Kansas City area and in the New York area as well. And I'm looking forward to hearing all about that, Ian. Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Theodore Swetz is with us again. He is the professor of theater and head of acting for the well-known MFA acting program over at UMKC. He was an original member of the American Players Theater. Stella Adler was one of the people he worked with over there. Many other performers as well. Looking forward, Ted, to hearing a little bit about that later on in the show.
Sure. Great to be here.
Nice to have you on the show with us today. Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. The tiger, you are the tiger, Ted. I guess the tiger is a metaphor, as it were.
Yeah, this show is filled with wonderful metaphors. And, you know, depending on your point of view, it's going to bring to light as an audience member what you're going to center your experience on. But for me, you know, I get to say things like, you know, zoo is hell. Ask any animal.
That's right.
You know, and what this playwright has done is just put this wonderful metaphor of a caged animal. I feel, you know, one could look at it and say, you know, the soldiers we send to these wars are in their own cage there. I'm looking at myself as a prisoner of war being in a zoo. There's all sorts of wonderful metaphors. And it also takes place in the Baghdad Zoo, and Ian can be very eloquent about this. There's a garden of topiary. The symbolism of it is undeniable in regard to the beginning of time and faith.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. So the play takes place in Baghdad, which is thought by many to be the beginning of civilization, perhaps.
Sure.
Where the Garden of Eden was. And there are these incredible topiary in the show. They're all shaped like animals, and they've... they tell their own story. They were originally plants. They were shaped by humans to be these amazing animals, life-size animals. And through this war, they were bombed, destroyed, and now, once again, they are returning to their natural form, sort of growing out. And so they provide some really incredible visual imagery in the production, but also have their own sort of layered story to tell.
So we're looking at the second part of the Iraq War, as far as the United States is concerned, is separated early 1990s, early 2000s. This is, what, 2003,
yes,
something like that?
The play takes place in 2003, just after the U.S. invasion. And the play starts from a little news clipping that the playwright read in the back page of the New York Times. It was an AP story, just a couple paragraphs long, about how two soldiers were hanging out in the zoo, and one was trying to feed a tiger, and got his hand bitten off, and the other one shot the tiger dead.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where our playwright started his story. He was just fascinated by the metaphors there of, you know, of shooting this animal and of animals' point of view in war and sort of how they are really affected by it too. So he started as a school project, just a little school assignment. He wrote the first scene. Most people didn't like it very much, so he put it in the drawer for a couple years, and later he pulled it out, finished it into a full-length play, and got a Pulitzer nomination for it. So
sometimes things take time. If you're a little too close to the situation, I guess it would be more difficult. As time passes, a little more leeway there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I first read about the show, I said, well, they actually went into the zoo. They actually shot the animals. Was that part of the assignment? Why couldn't you just leave the animals in the cages? Or was there no one around to feed them after the invasion?
The zoo was bombed. Yeah. The zoo was bombed. They had, I think at the time of the invasion, there were around 600 zoo animals, they almost all escaped. All escaped and were killed in the streets of Baghdad. Talk about chaos. Mm-hmm. Talk about the effect of war. Can you imagine, you know, not only the streets were literally on fire with bombs, and then you could turn a corner and see a bunch of lions at some point in the early invasion. This was absolutely hell on earth. One of the things that the playwright uses is that when I bite the soldier's hand off, I'm shot, and then my spirit leaves the cage, and then as a ghost, as a spirit in limbo, I walk the streets of Baghdad, and it is quite an education. And this playwright suggests that when you die, you start to learn more things. You know, you can make of that what you will. He really confronts, if there's a God, then he should be accountable for what he's done here. And is this what you meant life to be? Are you really not going to say anything about... At one point, you know, I feel I'm trapped because of my basic nature. I've killed children back in West Bengal when I was free. And to me, it's a very darkly funny play. It's a hysterical play. At one point, I talk about killing two children 16 years ago, and I say, it wasn't cruel. It was lunch. I say, a basic primordial impulse is not cruel. And then I say, but what if it is? What if my every meal was an act of cruelty, and I start to question my own nature. So it's a play that really will awaken people to faith itself. What is this thing that we're involved in? Why do men create war? Why do we have that savage appetite if this place was made by God? And why isn't he showing up to help us? It is an incredible piece, a real fable of faith.
Yeah, did the author expand it from the short piece you were talking about? Did he get more input when he wrote the short piece? You say he put it away and expanded on it.
Yeah, I think it was after graduate school that he picked it up again, and I know that he developed it at the Lark Playwriting Center in New York, and had various other he had a grant from the NEA to help develop it further, but. Yes, absolutely. From the three characters that the play starts with, it expands greatly from there, and a whole cast of characters comes into play that are all stories. There are many stories, and all of them become interrelated, and we see the connections. But at first, it is a little strange that we start with a tiger, and we get to a translator, and a dead dictator's son, and there's some wild cast of characters in this play.
Did you ever had a chance to meet Mr. Joseph, the playwright?
I have not met him myself, no, but I know that there was a recent interview in The Star with him that was really fascinating. So it was great that he got to speak about the production here.
Yeah, well, you're a director, but a designer as well, mm-hmm. of lighting and stage. How much of this did you want to tackle on your own?
Oh, my goodness. This play is just enormous, and I did not want to tackle it on my own because it has so many elements, so many things going on. And it needs to be a large play. You know, a lot of times as a director and a designer, you want to make things as simple as you can so you can just tell the story, the heart of the story. Now, I think that's still true of what we've done with this play, but it needs some of these incredible, fascinating, beautiful elements that it has. So we were really lucky. This is a co-production with the UMKC Theater Department, and so we had a fantastic team of graduate students that designed with us, and in fact, one of our designers was also the head of the costume design program. He did the costumes for this play, so it was incredible to have him on board. He's a real artist.
What's great about that collaboration is that enables the Unicorn to do some plays they just couldn't afford to do budget wise. You know, our first collaboration was, I don't know, about 10 years ago when we did The Lieutenant of Inishmore. And you need a bigger budget to do that. And this is a perfect example how these two artistic programs can come together and make something really special. And that's really exciting for us.
Go ahead.
It's a perfect win-win, too. You know, these students get an opportunity to work on these sort of larger scale productions. They get to have a full production at a wonderful theater like the Unicorn, and the Unicorn gets to work on shows that they wouldn't be able to do on their own. So it's really an exciting collaboration that these two institutions have.
And we've got three of our MFA actors in the piece, and they're doing just great work.
Incredible.
Yeah, we're speaking with Theodore Swetz, who plays the role of the Tiger, part of UMKC during his normal daily activities, and Ian R. Crawford, the director, also a designer, all of that with credits in both New York and here in Kansas City. When you first came here, were you surprised at what goes on here in Kansas City? A lot of people from New York have told me they are.
Yeah, you know, I was really excited. I'd heard great things, and I'd visited Kansas City before I moved here. When I moved here, the Kauffman Center was just opening. It seemed like there was a real watershed moment of fantastic arts really growing in this town, and so I was very excited to take part in it and find my little way into the Kansas City art scene. I've really loved it. I've produced some of my own work and worked with some incredible theater companies in town, and I'm really excited about this collaboration with the Unicorn.
Glad to have you here. We're speaking with Ian R. Crawford, the director, and Ted Swetz, who plays the role of the Tiger. As the spirit of this tiger traverses through the streets of Baghdad, what kind of individuals does he meet up with?
Well, the basic idea is that I don't know why, but I seem to be haunting or hanging around the person who killed me. And then
I could see that.
and then when he dies, he hangs around the person that was basically the biggest relationship, the soldier that he had a relationship with, who comes back. This limbo idea, I think the playwright, in this horrible cauldron of war, we're supposed to be learning some lessons. We're supposed to be questioning existence and acceptance of existence. So I get to roam the streets of Baghdad, and at one point, I come in and I say to the audience, this place is lousy with ghosts, and the new ones are irritating. They're walking around wide-eyed. What happened to me? Where am I? You're dead, and you're in Baghdad. Shut up. And then right after that, I meet a little girl. I won't do the monologue for you, but I'll just do the beginning. I serve as a chorus to the audience about my experience as I walk the streets of Baghdad. And I say, the other day I was walking down the street, and the street was literally on fire. And I say this, I see this little girl. Her life is like a soap bubble. And then pop, she's here, standing in the middle of the street, looking up at me. And then I have this wonderful, wonderful encounter with this pure, innocent spirit that makes me really have a conversation with God about why did you take this girl out? What's your plan? It's an incredible script.
Yeah, well, who knows what the plan is? I mean, we'll never know. Maybe in some form we'll know one day.
I don't know.
Who knows? But it is an interesting question, especially as this, I guess, a beast who's been imprisoned and now his spirit is free now to wander around. Does he have to do, and I don't want to connect it to any particular religion, I know it's pretty generic, but does he is he connected with any penance?
At one point I figure it out. I feel, wait a minute, I did kill two children before I was a prisoner of war in a zoo. Maybe I have to atone for that. What do I have to do? And I try that route to no avail. I even stop eating meat. I try for a couple of hours. I become a vegetarian. And that drives me crazy.
A tiger needs.
Yeah. So it's really a test of what is our responsibility as we're on this earth? Do we, you know, it's this primal soul. But if you look at it as a metaphor for mankind, you know, you understand that this appetite that a tiger has in a primal way means we're going to have war after war after war. When man gets hungry for ambition, there'll be another war. Hmm. And it's really quite a sobering fable.
It's interesting that he picked the tiger, I think. The tiger is such a proud, yet very basic animal. It has certain basic instincts, which it is destined to follow. And the way he compares that to mankind, I find very interesting.
Yeah, and I also have this love, well, mostly a hate relationship with lions.
Oh, really?
I start the play by saying, the lions escaped 2 days ago. Predictably, they got killed in about 2 hours. Everybody always gives lions so much credit. They're dumb as rocks.
So the animal kingdom has its own prejudices?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what makes the play fun. You know, at one point, I'm talking to them and saying, I'm stuck here. I don't know why I'm still here. I just thought everything ended. But here I am, Dante in Hades. And I look at the audience and I get to say, you didn't think I knew Dante, did you? And he goes, now that I'm dead, I'm learning all sorts of things.
I'll bet you do. I'll bet you do. Do you do anything special with the lights or anything at various portions of the show?
Sure. We have some incredible lighting in this show. Because the play has a real element of magical realism to it. We have that sort of gritty reality of what it means to be in a war-torn city, and these real moments of incredible beauty. And sometimes that beauty is a terrible thing, but there's a glint of humanity and beauty in it. So The lighting in this play is really something to see. It's really quite stunning. Our lighting designer, Chris, has done an incredible job.
Yeah. Tell us about your cast. Who did you pick? Why did you pick who you picked?
Well, we've got an incredible cast on this show. We've got three students, as Ted said, that are part of the MFA program at UMKC. That's Danny Fleming, Michael Thayer, and Miriam Diaz. Two of those actors play Iraqi characters, so they also speak Arabic. They speak English and Arabic. And Danny Fleming plays one of our American soldiers. All really strong actors doing fine work. And we just had a talk back the other day, and someone said, you know, sometimes you can guess who might be a student and who might be a professional actor on when you see, you know, student work. And they said, with these guys, I couldn't even begin to guess. They're doing such fine work. So I was really proud of them for that.
I thought it was a challenge with them learning to speak the Arabic. You told me earlier none of them had any experience with that.
My gosh, yes. It's a very challenging aspect of rehearsing this play was that there's quite a bit of Arabic in the show, and none of our actors have any background in Arabic, speaking it, really. But we were fortunate enough to find an incredible man named Kais, who is a PhD student at UMKC, and he is an Iraqi man, and he's here to get a degree so that he can return home and help his country. And meeting with him and talking to him was incredibly powerful, not to mention the incredible help that he did for us with recording all of the Arabic lines and sort of breaking it down syllable by syllable so they could learn it. And then coming in and giving some help and critique on the sound of it so that they could nail just the precision of the speech so that then they could take it and embody it and really fill it with life in the moment that they needed to do as actors and characters in the play. So it was a very challenging thing, but something that adds an incredible layer to this story.
Yeah, the divisions of situations, I guess it would be the best way to put it. They all have interactions with the tiger. Does the tiger have a name? I've been calling Tiger.
No,
does
he? No, just the tiger.
Tiger, yeah. I guess they don't name.
No, but I,
we
but
name
I,
animals. I guess they don't name.
Well,
them,
I so. Do have more information about those lions, but, though. I say, oh. I say, Leo, the head lion. I mean, they were all named Leo.
That's conditioning, I think, more than anything else. Yeah, I find it interesting that there's rivalries among the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's very. The playwright is very clever in choosing the tiger as our narrator, and he gives him a lot of. Human qualities, but he's not a human. He's not an American. He's not an Iraqi. He doesn't come from it with any political bias. He can really sort of see the situation with fresh eyes. But Tiger gets to say great things like, you know, we, all tigers. It's just slipped my mind.
Well, I find it interesting. Ted spoke of him earlier as a prisoner of war. I suppose if you were a tiger, that's kind of how you would look at it.
Well, if you're a tiger in a zoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he says, you know, imagine you're out, it's your everyday routine. Maybe you want to grab a bite, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a tranquilizer dart comes, and you wake up in Baghdad, and he goes, that was depressing. You know, he also, the playwright's great. He just uses the tiger as this great vehicle to talk about great philosophies. At one point I say, you know, the fact is tigers are atheists, all of us, unabashed, you know, and it's, you know, he can bring up big issues with this tiger, and it's sort of a neutral place, you know, and it, you just I'd be able to put these in the air, and it clashes against, you know, at one point there's the call to prayer, and I say, you know, this garden is surrounded by minarets calling people to prayer, and I look at the audience, I say, wow. Calling out to God in this mess, can you believe it?
Yeah.
You know, it's they're huge ideas, and that's why we love performing it. And Ian did a beautiful job directing it, because it was the hardest play to rehearse I've ever experienced, because there's so many big ideas. And then after we lived with it for a while, with Ian watching it with his third eye, he said, guys, we're just going to play the circumstances. All the big ideas are in it. We're going to let the audience pick and choose how they want to look at it. And that was very helpful. And so we just present the circumstances, and we believe in what we're doing. And it's a very rich experience for an audience. You know, the other actors in it, we should mention, are Damron Armstrong, who plays Uday Hussein, and Manon Halliburton. And she's the one person in the whole play, she doesn't speak one word of English. She is incredible in this.
Yeah, yeah. An incredible actress in town. And doesn't only speaks Arabic. And she has two different characters, very different, but both stunning and really... really memorable moments. So she does incredible work.
Yeah, let's get to the basic facts here. What's going to happen? The show runs through December the 28th. It's basically, as I look at the schedule here, there are some Wednesdays at least.
Oh no, we go Tuesdays too.
Tuesday through Sunday.
No, we do. It's a full out effort. Come see us
Tuesday, but the only matinee. I guess I see a matinee on Saturday as well. I was going to say just Sunday as well. I think what you have to do is go to their website or give them a call to get the basics on what you need to do. The Unicorn Theater is at 3828 Main, just down the street from where we are. If I made a really good throw, I could maybe hit the front window.
But if you did it, you're going to be on the Kansas City Chiefs immediately.
Yes, and they turned the tiger loose on me as well. 3828 Maine. If you need to MapQuest things, 64111. The number to call for more information, 816-531-PLAY. If you're not so good at translating, it's 531-7529. And, of course, online, the best place to get all this information about dates and times, unicorntheater.org. As we close out our interview here with Ian Crawford and Theodore Swets, from New York, you've been a designer. Any high points of your career so far?
Oh my gosh, this is the high point of my career. I'm so excited. This is the first show that I'm directing at the Unicorn, and I couldn't have chosen a more challenging, beautiful play to have be my first here at the Unicorn. I'm really proud of it, and it's really something stunning. Something everyone's got to see.
Yeah, as I mentioned at the beginning, Ted was one of the original members of the American Players, worked with Stella Adler. Did she perform as well as teach?
No, I worked with Stella when I was a young actor in New York, where she taught, and she defined my artistic road. Stella would love this production.
Oh. Good to know. What was that experience? Did that...
it was a defining artistic moment of my life. I studied with Stella for 2 years when I was in my mid-20s, and I'm going to be 62. And that experience has totally defined the artistic road I travel today.
Yeah, well, he teaches in the MFA program. We don't have the time to go into it now, but you pick a certain number of performers.
Oh, yeah. I'm about to go out and recruit, and I'll see over 800 actors to pick eight.
Just imagine the... Because they probably don't realize they're in competition.
Oh, yeah, they do. Everybody knows. It's quite a... I'll go to Chicago, New York, and San Francisco, and then we'll have auditions here.
Sure. So the Unicorn Theater production, one of two that's going... In my words, but in repertory, they stagger the time so they don't interfere with each other. Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, and that'll be running through December the 28th at the Unicorn Theater, 816-531-PLAY, or online at unicorntheater.org. Thanks, guys, for being with us.
Thanks for the invite. Yeah.
Thank you.
To find out what happens to that tiger, and does he learn?
Well, you have to come and find out.
That's right. We're going to take a break. When we return, the other half of that repertory at the Unicorn, a famous Hollywood agent. Some say that she was the first superstar female agent. We'll hear all about that when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Did you know that God was a whiny and petulant 10-year-old boy with a British accent? Well, that's just one of the revelations in Ridley Scott's bizarre miscalculation, Exodus, Gods and Kings. This revisionist look at the same biblical territory covered by Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments delivers some impressive spectacle, but also some laughable dialogue and oddball casting. European Christian Bale is Moses, and Australian Joel Edgerton is Ramesses, and they make do with what they've been given. Scott tries to have it both ways, allowing audiences to decide for themselves whether the events are natural or supernatural, and whether Moses was a prophet or merely delusional. That wishy-washy attitude sinks it. Thou shalt skip Exodus. Here are the top five things about the comedy Top 5. 1. It's outrageous. 2. Irreverent. 3. Profane. 4. Funny. And 5. Chris Rock's best movie. Top 5 is a kind of film that Woody Allen wishes he still made. Rock wrote, directed, and stars in this extremely raunchy comedy about a popular comedian whose career is on the skids when he tries to go dramatic. While it's very crude and edgy, Top 5 bristles with the kind of smart and insightful humor that has become Rock's trademark. The Babadook is an exceptionally well-made Australian horror film about things that go bump in the night. Essie Davis and Noah Wiseman are terrific as a single mom and her disturbed son who are haunted by an entity from a children's book. While the elements are familiar, rarely have they been put together so skillfully. Also opening this week, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is the first ever Iranian vampire western. Last Days in Vietnam is a documentary about the war's chaotic climax. And Point and Shoot is a documentary about an American who takes a trek through the Middle East only to get caught up in the fight against Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
Bridging the Gap's Green Pocketbook program on Echo Radio KC, Monday at 6 p.m.
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, we at KKFI are always bragging about the rich, diverse, talented, deep music scene here in our listening area. Well, that goes for Christmas music as well. Join me Wednesday morning from 6 to 8 for 2 hours of the best of local Christmas music, including, once again, a live in-studio performance from the Snow Globes. That's Wednesday morning from 6 to 8.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
90.1 FM presents the very first Mind the Gap Club Night, Saturday, December 20th from 10 p.m. on at the Mini Bar, 3810 Broadway, featuring DJ Bobby Bone, DJ Avant Garde, DJ the DJ, and myself, JZ, on the lineup. Tickets are $5 at the door. Join us for music, dance, and mayhem. More information at kkfi.org.
Dreidels and Donuts on the Pacifica Radio Archives from the Vault, Wednesday morning at 5.
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host, the second part of two shows running in repertory at the Unicorn Theater. It's not as big as the rep, and they have two shows going, but there's two shows going over there. The first one we talked about, Bengal Tiger, that's on the main stage. This one is at the Jerome Theater, which I sometimes will refer to as the Jerry. Nobody likes that joke, so I just dropped it. But Donna Thomason is with us. She plays, and it's a one-woman show, as I understand it. Sue Mengers. Sue Mengers was a Hollywood super agent. Ryan O'Neill was her client. Farrah Fawcett was her client. Nicholson as well?
She had almost all of the stars of the late 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s. They were all her stars. Ally McGraw, Peter Bogdanovich, Michael Caine, just practically every the who's who of stars were under Sue's control.
Yeah, and this is, it's, from the previews I saw, kind of a funny, sometimes poignant piece about her and her dealings. Donna, by the way, has been in local theater and local film for years. I've seen her, for instance, quite a bit at Quality Hill Playhouse.
Yes.
She appeared on Broadway in Annie, at the Unicorn, at Starlight, at American Heartland Theater. Mm-hmm. I've also saw her in American Heartland Theater as well. She was in the films Ride with the Devil, Article 99, Silence, among other things. But she's now also, she's acting now.
That's right.
Also in the corporate world.
That's right.
I wrote it down here, Donna.
Epic Events.
Which is a
wholly owned subsidiary of Starlight Theater. We do custom events around Kansas City and around the country, and actually have a client that takes us to Beijing, China.
Wow.
Once a year to manage some things for them.
Yeah.
So
actors complain about the suits, as they call it.
The suits. Now, I've become a suit.
You're an actor and a suit
That's
at the
right.
same time.
It depends on the time of day, whether I have my suit on.
And how ironic that you would then play an agent who would deal with people like you.
Exactly. I'm learning how to deal with myself.
Did you know much about Sue Mengers before?
I was aware. I'm of an age, Michael. So I was aware
probably
of...
younger than me.
I was aware of Sue Mengers, certainly. And saw the Mike Wallace 60-minute interview when she really became the star that she was representing. She was the very first, first female agent For the superstars. And there were, of course, there was the studio execs and all of those kind of the male-dominated system in Hollywood at that time. But there weren't any women that were doing what she was doing. And she took it to a new level and really only represented people, was big in the business for about 10 or 12 years before her star started to fade a little bit and her very, very well-known clients started to jump ship. But probably the most well-known star and the one that is really prominent in this particular play was Barbara Streisand. She and Barbara were friends from New York City. She moved to L.A. as a friend of Barbara's. Barbara really helped put her on the map in Hollywood by, as Sue says, schlepping me to parties. Barbara took me everywhere, and Barbara put her on the map. And this particular night of this play, we are sitting waiting for a phone call, the call that will actually let us all hear that Barbara herself is firing Sue and letting her go. The lawyers have called earlier in the day to say that, but this is an evening of waiting for Barbara to call. And on the eve of what were, she was very well known for her dinner parties. I mean, that's where only A-list celebrities could get into these dinner parties. She has a line that says, honey, my own mother couldn't get in here if she was standing outside in the rain. It's all twinklies here. So she referred to her stars as twinklies, and this is a night that we're waiting for Streisand to call and let her go, which was really kind of the beginning of the end for Mangers. It was a time that forced her into what that question that we all reach in our lives, what's next?
Yeah.
And so there are some hilariously funny parts to the evening, but also some very poignant parts because Mengers was, she was born in Germany. She was born in Hamburg. She and her mother and father escaped Mr. Hitler when he started getting stroppy, as she says. Moved to Utica, New York. She was an outcast. She felt as though she was an outcast when she first arrived in Utica. She didn't speak the language at all. She wanted desperately to be accepted, and I think that really impacted the choices that she made throughout her life. She worked very hard to learn the language. She learned it by watching movies, which is where this great fascination for movies and movie stars came from. But she took it a step further, and she took elocution lessons as a child, really to get rid of that accent. That was one of the things when I actually, there's very little actual film of her, but there is that Mike Wallace interview, that 60 Minutes interview. And the thing that struck me so when the first time I saw it was that here was this girl who was Jewish, who was of German descent, who had absolutely no accent whatsoever. And it's because she took elocution lessons and worked so hard to be totally accepted. And that kind of defined how she went through her life. But she was a definite force to be reckoned with. She was fearless. She was ferocious in the way she defended her clients, in the way she went after studio bosses. Besides being considered kind of a barracuda, I don't think I can say that other B word on the air, but she was very much considered that and disliked by a number of people. I think there is a really admirable, tenacious broad in there that I really love, and that's why I love playing her.
Yeah, there's little tidbits in the show. We hear her talking about various things. For instance, pushing Ryan O'Neal for The Godfather.
That's right. Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. She did. That didn't go. A lot of her things didn't go well, and she would like cast stuff in her head, you know. And then she would just. I mean, she was relentless. She didn't make a phone call, you know, and say, hey, I'd like to have you consider blah, blah, blah for this part. I mean, she would call 5 and 6 times a day. She would call hourly. I mean, I think you're talking about Robert Evans talks about the fact that when she started pushing Ryan O'Neal for The Godfather, and he kept saying, who would put Ryan O'Neal in as The Godfather? And she kept saying, there are wigs. There are things you can do. Now, that's not in the play, but I mean, she just badgered him. I mean, badgered him. So she had a lot of people that didn't like her. She was tough. She was incredibly profane. That's why we won't be doing a lot of her lines here on the air, because we simply cannot. But she lived life to the fullest. She took a massive bite out of life, and she wrote it as hard as she could possibly write it.
It was an interesting story, but kind of a behind-the-scenes Sue's perspective behind the scenes of a Faye Dunaway getting the role in Chinatown.
Yeah,
that was funny.
We do reenact that phone call with Robert Evans. Yeah,
yeah. It's kind of did she work with him a lot? Because in the 60 Minutes piece, it shows them sitting at a table chatting. Right. How 60 Minutes got this piece, I'm not sure. Right. But she's pushing a script, and he's being very firm and no, Sue, but right. She keeps it up.
She does keep it up, and she and Robert Evans were great adversaries and also great friends. And he remained one of her friends even after she got out of the business and kind of semi-retired. There are a number of those people. I think because she was an only child, and because she was her father committed suicide when she was quite young. She was never apparently terribly close to her mother, or at least there was a lot of friction there. And she speaks a lot about how these stars were more than just her clients. They were her family. And when they started to abandon ship, and when they started to leave, when that kind of personal relationship that happened at the time that Mengers came in, when it was really just the agent and the artist, morphed into what creative artists started, which was really corporate control, managers, agents, an agent for television and an agent for, you know, stage and then all of the managers that got involved. It really turned into kind of a corporate managing of a star. When that started to happen and people started to abandon ship, it was more than just a business loss for her. It was really being shunned again, at least in my mind. That's kind of where that full mm-hmm. circle of vulnerability comes through. Really being shunned again by family, because they were her family. Allie McGraw, there's a very, I think, poignant moment in this play when Allie McGraw has married Steve McQueen after having been married to Robert Evans.
Oh, yes, yeah.
First. And she divorced Bobby Evans and she married McQueen. And McQueen really kept Allie apparently from working. And Sue and Allie have it out, and Allie says, you know, hey, listen, I'm going to stay here with him. I'm giving up the business. And it devastated her. It truly devastated her. Allie McGraw was also at her bedside when she died.
Oh.
So those kinds of things really, I think, bring the human quality into this woman that we consider to be simply a barracuda. She wasn't at
she
all.
She was with Creative Artist Agency.
No, she was with ICM.
She was with ICM.
CAA, Creative Artist Agency, came in and really kind of started taking over
okay.
in 1980, and really kind of, and all those stars that were with ICM and William Morris and a number of other agencies kind of jumped ship and went to the new big dog in town, which was CAA.
So she somehow got those people away and to her, and I guess turned about, I guess, is fair play eventually. Eventually,
yeah.
They got
yeah.
them away from her.
And they pulled them back, yeah.
Yeah, what's the most interesting thing you found about her? You're in both sides of the business. Do you know anyone that's even remotely like her?
Well, I have actually a friend in New York, Lola, my friend Lola, who is has a lot of the kind of delivery patterns, I guess, that I imagine Mengers to have had. She was a very bawdy but very funny woman, Mengers. My friend Lola is too. You know, I think that the thing that I found once I started, I mean, the first part of this, when you're doing a one-person show, which I had never done before, is just getting the sucker learned.
Oh, well, sure.
But then when you really, and that's, you know, that's the first kind of step in the process. I was blessed to have good friend and director Sydney Garrett kind of leading me through this maze and of not only language and text, but emotional content. But that's the first part of it. But then in my studying of Mengers then, the thing that I just really loved was this fierceness that she had, this kind of ferocious kind of attacking the world. She uses some symbolism in some stories that she tells about how difficult it was for her when she got to Utica to cross the playground, to go up to the most popular girl and carry on a conversation because she didn't speak the language and she had this horrible accent that she was horribly embarrassed about. And that kind of metaphor of crossing the playground figures prominently throughout this play and really in her life. It's the last tip she leaves us with. Go ahead, cross the playground. What have you got to lose? The credits roll sooner than you think.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that kind of tenacity, which I think I learned in spades from my dad. And is such an important part of me as a human being. Of people say no, and you know, I hear maybe, and Menger said the same thing. That kind of spirit of risking it all and never, even if you fail, pick yourself up and reinvent yourself and go on. I really admire that in human beings, and I would have admired that in Sue Menger's had we known each other.
We're speaking with Donna Thomason. She is Sue Menger's in the One Woman Show running currently at the Unicorn Theater. It will run through December 28th. The number to call for more information, same number we gave you for that other play, 816-531-PLAY. If you're better with the numbers, 531-7529. And of course, their website. And you're probably going to need the website because of the times, especially, and the dates. Unicorntheater.org. I've noticed that they stagger the times.
They do.
One will start 30 minutes before the other to get the audience in there.
Right. And we actually, during rehearsals, when Bengal Tigers just realized that there are tigers in both theaters, kind of. How about that? When Bengal Tigers had opened or was in previews and we were still in rehearsal because we came in a few days later, we made sure that some of the explosions and shots and stuff that happened to Bengal Tigers in that theater happened right before they happen at when they're at intermission is when we're quiet. And, you know, so the theaters are working and hand in hand to make sure that the experience is great for people in both theaters.
Yeah. Now you're just one person playing this lady. You have to establish an intimate connection with the audience, especially the ones down close. I would think you have to make them feel like they're in your living room.
Exactly. And Sid Garrett worked very hard with me on that and moved around in different chairs because it was a kind of a small group. But really, we as actors don't get the opportunity to break that fourth wall. And really, the other person in this character is that audience. So that's why those first preview performances were so scary and important, because finally I got the other character to talk to. Yeah, it's interesting to sit in and really make eye contact. I can see really the first three or four rows and talk to them all night long. And here's a, if you know, if you nod off, I see that.
Oh.
People don't know that when you're sitting out there in the dark, that we on the stage, we can see you.
Yeah.
When you go to sleep, we see that.
Oh, yeah. An actor told me once, the guy in the third row, I didn't like the way he was.
Even with that, you can tell people are fighting it. I'm sure I've been that person in an audience, too. But so far, we haven't lost anybody in this play. But we can see you when you go to sleep.
I would think it, from the little bits I saw, I would think you would keep the wisecracks coming at a pretty rapid clip.
It's a pretty funny play. There are just, as I said, her humor is such that it's just so over the top and it's just so in your lap. And truly, you have this person who is sitting right there staring at you saying some of this stuff, you know. So, the audience is a very important character in this play.
Yeah, and lest no one be confused, Sue Menger was a real person.
She was a real person.
Worked in Hollywood, represented the top drawer of talent in
those
days.
Oh my gosh, just the most incredible list of people.
What would she think of the stars today? They're not as glamorous as they used to be.
They are not as glamorous. You know, I think she kept her finger in it even after she retired. She would rep a few people here and there. And in the late days of these dinner parties, toward the very, very end, Tina Fey came to some of these dinner parties. Jennifer Aniston was a client of hers. Harry Hamlin was apparently a client of hers. Bette Midler, who did this part on Broadway last year, told a very funny story that someone relayed to me, that there is a point in the play when Menger's, who's had the carpets clean for the party that night won't walk on the carpets through this whole place. So I'm pretty much on the couch the entire night. Okay. But at one point, she needs a decanter of her alcohol, and she also needs her stash of dope.
Yeah.
So she brings some people up from the audience to go over and get those things for her. And one night, Bette Midler tells this story that there was this guy that came up. She called this guy up from the audience and at first didn't recognize him, thought he was kind of cute, and he was being problematic. And afterwards, she went back to her dressing room, and someone came to her and said, "Hey, Harry Hamlin would like to come talk to you." And she said, "Why?" And that's the guy she brought up. And he had been one of Menger's clients, artists, and had such an adverse reaction. I mean, he couldn't stand her by the time he dumped her as an agent, and had such an adverse reaction to seeing Midler playing her that he was just apparently difficult on stage. He had a little flashback or something. Anyway, so there were some of those later stars. She kept her eye apparently on Saturday Night Live to kind of see who the new talent was, up and coming talent. But the glory days of Hollywood and those dinner parties is a world that is gone. Yeah. I mean, imagine sitting at a dinner party, and they weren't huge. They were 8 to 12 people. And Gore Vidal, who was a good friend of hers, would be sitting talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, telling a story about Eleanor Roosevelt. Or, I mean, those kinds of things. And you felt safe. That's what I also kept reading, that all of those stars knew they could go there. They could talk about anybody that was there. They were going to run into studio bosses. She spent a great deal of time figuring out who she wanted to put with whom. There was nothing random about it. She says that evening was one long audition, and that's when her work was done. She would seat Anne Margaret intentionally next to who just died? Diane McNichols. She'd put them next together, and then that's how she got carnal knowledge. She walks away with carnal knowledge by dessert, is the line. So, it was all very planned, and it was where she did business. But those days are gone. I think they're gone forever.
I think so. If you can indulge me for just a minute, your husband of many years, Gary Holcomb, I had him on the show several times.
Yes, I know you did.
I remember he was doing a play with the other Gary.
Gary Neal? Yeah, Johnson?
People confuse the two Garys, I think.
So they didn't look
Gary
anything alike, but yeah.
Which Gary was this?
Right.
But they were both on the show, and they were doing a play where Gary played A, and the word he used was damaged. World War II veteran, and then he dropped during the interview that he himself was a damaged World War II veteran. I was very
Vietnam.
I was very touched by that.
Yeah. They did. They worked together a number of times, but that particular play was very haunting and difficult for Gary.
You both appeared on Broadway.
We did.
Did you meet in New York?
We met. I left the Broadway company of Annie and went out on the into the national tour, and Gary was playing Warbucks in the national tour of Annie, and we met then in that show. Did it subsequently for, I've done over 2,000 performances of Annie. Oh my gosh. And Gary did somewhere around, I think, 1,000 or 1,200 or something. We had an opportunity to do it together. The last time we did the show together was in 2004 when he played Warbucks and I directed it for Starlight. So, the show figures very prominently in our lives. One of the Annies was our flower girl at our wedding in 1984. so it's always an important show for us.
As well as performing occasionally. I've seen you at Quality Hill.
We were together at Quality Hill a little bit. We did Convenience together at the Unicorn, the only time we worked together at the Unicorn. We worked at the Rep together quite a bit. American Heartland Theater a lot.
Only have a minute or so, but Epic Productions.
Epic Events, yes. Epic is a wholly owned subsidiary of Starlight Theater. I started working for them as an event producer in around 2000 or 2002 and was still, of course, acting and directing in the city. But in the last five years, I guess, I became the president of Epic 6 years ago. So it's a very full 70-hour week with Epic. So,
your days must be busy.
sleep when I'm dead.
That's
what you do. But anyway, it's a great group out there. Yeah, wonderful group.
Just the particulars now. Once again, I'll Eat You Last, a chat with Sue Mengers, directed by Sydney Garrett.
Pretty name, isn't it?
Yeah. Sydney is, of course, is involved with the Shakespeare Festival every year. The play is by John Logan. I assumed he was probably close to Sue. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I don't actually. I think he knew her, but I don't think they were good friends.
Okay. Well, the number to call for more information is 816-531-PLAY or the website. And it's important in this instance because the show times are staggered with Bengal Tiger. So unicorntheater.org. The Unicorn, of course, is located just down the street from where we are right now, 3828 Main. And if you MapQuest things, the zip code you need to jot down, 64111. I want to thank Donna Thomason for coming.
Thanks,
I don't
Michael.
Think I've ever interviewed you before. Seen you many times.
Good, good. Thank you for having me, and we hope people come down and see Sue Mengers.
Yeah, this is a high-powered Hollywood
agent.
It's
a fast hour and 15 minutes, one act, and you're in, you're out, and you have a good time and go to dinner and
gives you a taste of how she operated, how she was perceived, and how she became as successful as she was.
The glittering life of Hollywood gossip.
That's right.
Come see us.
Perfect for Kansas City.
That's right.
Thank you very much for being
Thanks,
with
Michael.
Us.
Appreciate
Again,
it.
Again, unicorntheater.org, 816-531-PLAY. Thanks for being with us. The Jazz Insider is next. He has some great jazz planned for you today. Jazz from 1 to 3. Then we pick up with the blues. The blues from 3 to 6 p.m. right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI. Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.